Hello everyone, welcome to another one of these Great Thinkers videos. Today we're talking about Robert Michels, following hot on the heels of Mosca and Pareto. It's Elite Theory Week here this week at Academic Agent. I wrote this book some years ago, Populist Delusion, where there's a whole chapter on Robert Michels. He also strongly informs the analysis of this book, Applied Elite Theory. Now, Robert Michels is famous for coining the iron law of oligarchy. And I think it's important, first of all, if you haven't seen the videos on Mosca and Pareto, I would strongly recommend watching both of them before you tackle this one, because Michels, I would say, you know, there's the three classical elite theorists. Michels is definitely the third of them, not only because he was slightly younger than the other two, but also because he very much builds on the ideas of the first two and takes them as read. Okay. So that means you need to understand Mosca and Pareto before you get to the inner workings of the iron law of oligarchy. The way I put it is this: Michels, so Mosca and Pareto give the overall framework. They give the conceptual toolbox. What Michels does expertly in his famous book, Political Parties, is put meat on the bones, provides the detail, and goes into the how, goes into the actual mechanics of how it all works. And that is really what the iron law of oligarchy explains. What is the iron law of oligarchy? Every organization, no matter how democratic its origins, inevitably becomes ruled by a small and self-perpetuating elite. And what Michels does, you know, Mosca and Pareto were very much talking at the level of society or of an entire state or of an entire nation. What Michels does is he says, look, this is true all the way down, as I said before, down to the level of your local chess club. And that's not even a joke. You know, since he retired, my dad has been part of, he plays bowls, as many retirees do in the UK. He's part of a bowls club. And even in something like that, the level of politics, the level of oligarchy, the iron law of oligarchy persists even in something like a bowls club that is ostensibly organized for old people to have something to do. Okay, so this is... This is not just something that is true of politics, it is true of all things. It has also been true in the history of the internet. But back 10, 15, 20 years ago, when I first got online, right back to the late 90s, early 2000s, there was such a thing as forums. Everybody will remember that even forums of anonymous posters had the moderators and the admin, and over time, they tended to coalesce around a core group of individuals. And, even as, you know, in really quite trivial areas of life, like Batman fandom or Star Wars fandom, or, you name it, whatever your hobby is, this law still persists. So this is like a complete theory that goes into the most unexpected areas of life. It will also be true in the workplace. It will also be true in any organization that you're a part of where you see the iron law. And also, you can even see elite takeover. If people remember back to when the so-called SJW revolution or the woke takeover happened, it often started in those internet forums or in, you know, a specific department is taken over in the workplace. And that's basically how slowly but surely, this new group of this new ideology starts to take over every, not just institution, formal institution, but, at the level of the internet forum or the fan group or whatever it is. Okay. So it's actually, it's not just politics. It's a fascinating theory of just how people and groups work, how organization works, just on a human level. And Michelle's gives some very good reasons for why power concentrates in leadership, in, you know, the small organized minority. For a large organization, they require technical competence. They require coordination so that all the bits of the system knows what it's supposed to be doing. They require swift decision-making. And these functions cannot be delegated to the passive majority, who are everywhere and always passive, and in the words of Gustave Le Bon, feminine. Passive and feminine. Le Bon was somebody who also in the background is kind of influencing all of these guys as well. Three forces combine to make concentrated leadership permanent. So there's technical expertise. I'll just get myself out of the way here, which is specialized knowledge that creates dependency on a minority of trained officials. There is organizational complexity, that is the bureaucratic structures that require full-time administrators who accumulate authority. And, you know, if we go into the modern day university, over time, I think it's fair to say that power has drained away from disorganized academics and towards organized administrators. Many, if anybody's worked in a modern day campus, they will know the amount of power that has accumulated to these kind of management layer, bureaucratic, admin, HR, you know, these sorts of functions. Actually, the institutional power that they've grown up over time that is drained away from the academics who used to have a lot more power. So what I'm saying is it happens even on, you know, the level of any level you can think of, society-wide, organization-wide, down to the level of the bowls club, etc. There is also the mass passivity of the rank and file who lack the time, the motivation, and access, really, to challenge the incumbents. And I always think for Robert Michels that the university campus is a very good place where you can see so many of these mechanics play out in real time. Because as well as the power that accrues to the administrators, everywhere and always, in every university I've ever been to, there is a very active, motivated core of people who tend to take over the student union. Anybody who's ever been to university will remember the people who are involved with the student union. And they then have a habit of pursuing things that aren't that popular with the rank and file students. But think of the rank and file students. They're too busy going out, partying, drinking, putting various things up their nose, concentrating on their studies. Young ladies meeting young men and young men meeting young women. You know, writing poetry, whatever it is, they're more interested in all of those things to give their time and attention to sorting out, you know, whatever it is that the student union have planned. Okay, that is why the student union will get its way over the disorganized mass of the student body 10 times out of 10. Unless the student union does something so drastically unpopular, then people will write, you know, somebody will be motivated enough then to try to get involved in student politics. You know, they'll focus their efforts. But that's kind of rare to annoy people that much. Most of the time, the student union, you know, the people involved with it will just kind of self-perpetuate as one lot graduate and another, you know, they'll inculcate more into their ranks and more power accrues to them over time as well. And this is something that Robert Michels talks a lot about. A lot of the book is from his experiences being involved in the SDP, that was a socialist party in Germany at the start, just before World War One. And he was very frustrated at the inability of that party to stick to its principles, the inability of himself to get anywhere in that party. And he has some very vivid descriptions of his fellow kind of rank and file members of that party and how easily distracted they were. You know, anything else, eating a sandwich, picking their nose, whatever it is, they're not interested, basically. So they let the leadership get on with it at the end of the day. And actually, most people in most times and most places don't want the bother of leadership. So they leave it up to the leaders to take the decisions for them. And this is, let's say, a fact of human behavior. You could say it's an unfortunate fact of human behavior, but it is what happens. And, you know, often you resent those people who've taken charge or who've taken organizational, you know, they're often the sort of people that you don't like. But they took an interest. They were the ones who were organized. They were the ones who focused. You were doing something else. Picking your nose, eating a sandwich, you know, out trying to meet girls, whatever else. Okay. Democracy has a self-defeating logic, according to Michels. He identified a paradox at the heart of the modern democratic organizations. He's talking about, again, the political party. The very mechanism needed to make an organization function efficiently, that is, hierarchy, delegation, and specialization, erode the very values that gave it purpose in the first place. And in his case, he was talking about the egalitarian values of the socialist, of the SDP that he was part of, the Social Democratic Party. You get a democratic founding that is an organization born from egalitarian ideals and collective solidarity. Then you get growth and complexity, and success demands efficient coordination and professional leadership. And this is something that you see all the time in normal politics, even today, where the expertise required to message properly, to do PR, to maintain message discipline, to write policy, to present things in the correct way, that it brings a lot of people on board, to interface with the media, to interface with all the various sections of society, with business, with the legal system, with the judiciary. Let's think about the modern Labour Party here in the UK. When Jeremy Corbyn and his friends from Momentum took over the party, they had all the high ideals. They had all their principles. They had a groundswell of rank and file left-wing support behind them. But they had poor message discipline. They were not able to do all of those things that the spin doctors were able to do for Tony Blair, the Alistair Campbells and the Peter Mandelsons. That technical expertise. In fact, their technical experts deliberately undermined them because they were working for the other side. So you actually, that there's a very good case study of this in action, where Corbyn, unfortunately, does not have the technical skills to manage a modern party, even though he had the ideas that were popular with the base of his support. And this is an ongoing problem for the Labour Party, because they want to stay true to their ideals, but the oligarchical tendency, the need for technical expertise, keeps on pulling the party back to the centre and even to the right, towards the Tony Blairs and away from the Jeremy Corbyns. And this is really the dialectic in action. So then you get oligarchic consolidation. The leaders entrench themselves. The founding ideals are subordinated to mere organizational survival. Again, to try to bring this, because in all of these lectures, I want to try to bring you back to real life examples, concrete examples, so you know what I'm talking about. The whole debate in the modern day Labour Party is people like Jeremy Corbyn saying we need to be true to our socialist ideals. to our left-wing ideals. We need to live up to what this party is meant to be about, a workers' party. And then on the other side, you've got Tony Blair saying, listen, if you do that, you're not going to win the next election. If you do that, you know, that's not a responsible thing to do. You need to I understand why you're saying it, but if you want to be pragmatic, if you want power, if you want to get things done in this system, you have to compromise that ideal and that ideal and that ideal and that ideal in the name of pragmatism, in the name of power, in the name of getting things done, in the name of getting elected. This is Tony Blair in a nutshell. Tony Blair, in many ways, is the embodiment of the iron law of oligarchy as it pertains to the Labour Party in Britain. But then if you're a true left winger, you look at the Tony Blair Labour Party and you say, hold on, this has nothing to do with Iraq war, you know, serving the interests of financial elites. What has this got to do with what I signed up for? This has got nothing to do with anything. I want kind of left wing stuff. What's going on? Oh, well, you know, forget about all that. We need power now. And the same thing happens the other way around. The same thing happens, on the right as well, where your principles are sold out for oligarchic consolidation. And this, the reason it's self-defeating is because this very process that goes on disillusions people. It disillusions generations of people who feel like they never get a chance to have their ideals put into practice ever, because the system keeps on doing this. You know, one of the examples I have in the populist delusion is the AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, who was pretty young when I wrote the book. It's 4 years on now, and I keep on checking back in on it to see if my prediction came true. The question is, did the Democrat Party become more like AOC over time, or did the AOC become more like Nancy Pelosi over time? And I think the answer is that the AOC became more like Nancy Pelosi over time, because the system changes you. You don't change the system. And that's the iron law of oligarchy in a nutshell. Let's talk more about the apathy of the mass. The majority is delighted to find persons who will take the trouble of looking after their affairs. I already touched on this on one of the previous points. Michelle argued that ordinary members lack the time, the technical knowledge, and the sustained motivation to engage meaningfully in complex organizational decisions. This is not a moral failing. It is just a structural condition that leaders routinely exploit to consolidate their position. The fact of the matter is, most people in most places want somebody else to do it. That's why there's a rally around the leader. That's why everybody looks towards the great man. That's why everybody's looking for a savior all the time, because they need somebody else to do it. The number of people who are actually prepared to roll up their sleeves and do that organization, well, I'd rather somebody else do it. And this is, again, not a judgment on those people. Those people have got other priorities. They want to live their lives. They want to go and walk their dog. They want to go to the gym. They want to work their job. They don't want to have to worry about all of this. They want somebody else to deal with it. And actually, when the apathy of the masses is sufficiently shaken, that is a sign that things are going wrong somewhere, because discontent is trickling down and disturbing their kind of beautiful, blissful ignorance, if you want to put it that way. Things have got bad enough that they are forced to take an interest now, just like the student union who takes decisions that annoys the mass of the student body. You don't want the student body taking notice, because now they're taking notice. Now they want to get involved. That's basically what populism is. That's what has happened here. So actually, you know, if business was running as usual and running well, in a well-ordered, in a good society, the apathy of the masses is actually all right. Okay, because, you know, a wise elite, a good elite, is just running things quite well. Yes, there could be some skimming off the top. Yes, they could do some things in their own interests, but it's, you know, basically things are working, so nobody has to worry. It's when things aren't working that this apathy is shaken, and that's really where you start getting trouble. However, Michel's, and there was plenty of discontent in the Germany of his age, okay? Michel's complaint was, even when then the apathy of the masses is shaken and you start to organize, you get involved in these political parties, the process just starts again. The iron law of oligarchy just comes about again and again and again through a kind of necessity. And it's iron because it's extremely difficult to escape. Not because they're just that good or whatever, but because of the structural makeup of the thing. It's like trying to escape the logic of 2 + 2 = 4 or something like that. I mean, theoretically you might be able to do it, but the fact is you're always going to end up with 2 + 2 = 4. And this is really the logic of the iron law. You know, the fact of mass and scale means you need organization. The fact that there are so many people to talk to means you need those technical skills to communicate to them. And there's no outside of this. At the moment here in the UK, there's a fledgling party, Restore Britain, under Rupert Lowe. There's a bunch of young guys doing their best. However, they do not have the technical professional expertise of, let's say, a Peter Mandelson or Alastair Campbell or Tony Blair or people who've been there for 40, 50 years at this point running the show. That means that they have an absolute disadvantage against those parties that have those skills. If Restore Britain that gained enough success and momentum, it will become inevitable at some point that that layer of organization, either the people themselves are going to have to get really good at it, like as good as the best that the other parties have got, okay, or Rupert Lowe would be forced to bring in outside help, bring in expertise, bring in people who really know what they're doing. So he gains the organizational expertise, but what he loses is the heart of the principle, the heart and soul of what it was. Now it's started to turn into something else. What's it started to turn into? Well, just the same as all the other parties. And you see, that's why it's an iron law. It's so hard to escape it. It take to overcome it would take absolute iron will on you know, in this scenario where it's Restore Britain, for example. You know, not only would they have to have the success of rising in the first place, but also when you get to that crunch point, Rupert Lowe and his team there are going to be like, no, we're going to just keep the same people through iron will. It doesn't matter how much pressure there is on us to bring in outside help, we're going to stick with the same people, i.e. a vanguard. How many parties in history have been able to do that? You can honestly count them on two, like you can count them on two hands. We're talking Lenin and the Bolsheviks, you know, who absolutely refused to cooperate with other parties, who absolutely refused to bring in outsiders. That's because Lenin was a vanguardist. But, you know, you could also have a look at various other parties. But you understand the principle. 9 times out of 10, that doesn't happen. Most of the time, you know, pragmatism wins out. And that it's that pragmatism again, just like Tony Blair and the Corbynistas, that pragmatism, when it wins out, then starts moderating the party, whether it's right or left, back to the status quo, back to the center. This is the iron law of oligarchy. Now, when leaders pursue their own interests, we start to have a problem. Once in power, leaders undergo a gradual but decisive transformation. And Michel says that this is basically psychological, that this is the best analogy was actually given to us by J.R. Tolkien. It's the ring. It's Gollum's ring. It's the ring of power. You put it on and then you get addicted to, like, now I've got a taste of power. Can I give it up? It is said that Margaret Thatcher cried herself to sleep at night when she was removed from 10 Downing Street. She never got over the fact of being a former prime. She'd never got over it. She always wanted to come back. Tony Blair left office in 2007. It is 2026, and you can tell he does not want to give it up. Okay, there is some, it's like its own aphrodisiac. It's its own, it's insatiable. They just, I've got power. I want more of it. I want more of it. I'm not going to give it up. It's mine. It's the precious. This is basically what Robert Michels is describing when this process starts taking over. And you can actually see it in American politics, where you've got these decrepit 80 and 90 year old senators, okay, bodging up the Congress, refusing to move. Larry Ellison at the age of 80, not going anywhere. You know, partly this is a result of people dying later and the, you know, the boomer generation having better healthcare, but also it is this process that he's talking about. Why would I give up power now? The organization ceases to be a vehicle for its founding goals and becomes instead an instrument for the preservation of elite privilege. What is the purpose of the Democratic Party in America? Is it social justice and equality, or is it Nancy Pelosi's bank account and Nancy Pelosi's career? Is it providing a lifetime sinecure for Chuck Schumer, or name your favorite Democrat? Exactly the same thing is true of the Republicans, by the way. This is not a left or right thing. It is true of every establishment party. It's an instrument for the preservation of elite privilege. Michels observed that this was a universal tendency, not an exception. Leaders begin to conflict their personal survival with the organization's survival. So even in, you know, when people really want to cling on, I mean, you know, I've mentioned Peter Mandelson a few times. He, you know, got to a point where he was putting his own, like he was even jeopardizing the Labour Party for his own self-betterment and his own self-enrichment, led to a huge scandal, of course. So you can see that original goals, you know, whatever they were, member welfare, the advancement of the mission, socialism, whatever it is, become overtaken by personal interests, self-preservation, status, the maintenance of status, and re-election. Bureaucracy also, I've touched on this when I talked about the university administrators, but bureaucracy itself becomes an instrument of oligarchy. The administrative structure that is built up, and the structures that build up in every organization, do not merely facilitate governance, but they entrench the ruling minority. Michels identified bureaucracy as one of the most powerful reinforcing mechanisms of oligarchic control. And his descriptions, he really has it in for bureaucrats. He sees the bureaucrat as a kind of, you know, today, these days, you'd call them a kind of midwit character. But yeah, he has genuine vehemence in his descriptions of them. I picked out a couple of my favorite ones here in the Populist Delusion, if I can find them. Well, you'll have to read it yourself. But I really thought it was one of the kind of coolest parts of political parties. Back when I was studying it, was just how much venom Michels has for the bureaucrat. You know, kind of a man, like a man who lacks talent, somebody who's just unexceptional. And in many ways, you can see this sort of character actually rise up and enter politics as well. I mean, dare I say it, Keir Starmer strikes me as one of these sorts of figures, a kind of system man, a bureaucrat in the truest sense. Bureaucrats have specialized knowledge. Officials command technical information unavailable to ordinary members, creating irreplaceable expertise. And some fields of knowledge, of course, deliberately make themselves more arcane. I don't know if any lawyers watch this, but I am convinced that lawyers delight in writing legalese, basically incomprehensible gobbledygook that means nothing to anybody but lawyers, as a way of gatekeeping out and protecting, right, their grift, essentially. But this goes on in every field. You get institutional memory, which is long-tenured administrators holding procedural knowledge that newcomers cannot easily replicate. Okay, and you do, I mean, you can think of organizations that you've been part of. You know, you've got all of these systems that work because, you know, Deirdre has been there for 20 years. How does it work? Oh, ask Deirdre. We don't know. You know, this goes on in every organization. And of course, you have gatekeeping. That is control over information flows, formal channels which allow elites to manage dissent and suppress challenges. Okay, and think of how curated and gatekept public media is. Think of how many voices are kept out of that conversation and which conversations are allowed in. And you think, because you have the populist delusion in your head still, many of you, that social media has broken down all these barriers. But you're wrong. Even at the level of social media, you will spot the genuine elites pump each other up and ignore the people who are not one of them. They subtly gatekeep out those people who are not allowed to be part of the conversation and boost each other and cite each other. Okay, boost up each other and ignore all the other people. That's generally how you know the difference between someone who's a member of the club and someone who's not. Because they invite each other on to their shows, or they cite them, or they quote tweet them, or they bring them in various ways. Whereas other people don't get those sorts of invites. You'll know from your own knowledge of these things. And at some level, at the back of your head, you may be aware of it, but you'd be surprised how many people overlook all of these things who can't see the obvious, subtle gatekeeping that goes on, even in nominally open spaces like Twitter X or YouTube or various other things that are less tightly controlled than legacy media, but they are still subtly being controlled through these sorts of mechanisms. Now, the Iron Law, this, by the way, is one of the reasons why socialists and Marxists tend not to like the elite theorists, because Michels was a socialist and later he ended up, just like Pareto, supporting, at least at the early parts, Mussolini's fascist party, because Michels became extremely disillusioned with the political left and with socialism with socialists in general, because he saw what went on in the SPD. This was really the basis, the empirical anchor for a lot of what he wrote about in Political Parties. And he said, look, the mass membership was ideologically committed, okay? But despite its explicitly egalitarian socialist program, the SPD by 1911 had developed a professional bureaucratic apparatus, a stable leadership caste, and a marked reluctance to pursue radical action that might jeopardize organizational assets. In other words, they'd done a Tony Blair on the Jeremy Corbyns of the party, and the party existed in effect merely to perpetuate itself. And the final straw, the thing that led Michels to write his book, Political Parties, was the SDPD had always been anti-war party. They had always been anti-war. And yet, in order to get a little taste of power on the eve of the First World War, they switched and they became pro-war. to match the rest of the establishment parties in Germany at that time, they became pro-war. And that was the final straw for Michels. Does it ring any bells? Somebody who's elected on being anti-war, but then becomes somehow pro-war. Also, charisma and organization are mutually reinforcing. Okay, so people who have charismatic authority are able to attract resources to themselves, and then it self-perpetuates because they're able to then draw more people like that to their side. They inherit organizational machinery. They get emotional. They can mobilize people under them through their manipulation of persuasion skills and rhetoric. And so, the absolute advantage tends then to accumulate and self-perpetuate over time, because if you're like this, you're going to end up in one of those, you know, it's going to attract more and more people like that. Now, back when we were talking about Carlyle, he would say, well, these are all the worst people. Like, all of these are absolute charlatans who are being attracted to these roles. These are all the worst sorts, just like bureaucracy attracts that kind of horrible mediocrity, middleman type of person that Michels likes. These sorts of roles attract charlatans and people who are good at lying, essentially. And this, Carlyle said, was one of the major defects of democracy. But Michels was saying, well, look, as long as this is the game, as long as mass mobilization and persuasion is the game, it's going to keep on self-perpetuating. He draws on Max Weber and his concept of charisma. Michels observed that magnetic personal authority does not bypass organizational structures. It uses them. Leaders leverage their charismatic appeal to command loyalty within the apparatus, whilst the organization amplifies their reach far beyond what personal influence alone could achieve. And you could say that Donald Trump in America has kind of done this with the apparatus of the existing GOP and all of the other things that have built up around him. Okay, and he's a pretty good modern example of this. Why is oligarchy technically inevitable? Well, for Michels, it's not a pathology, it is an engineering problem. Modern mass society is simply too large and complex to be governed by any other means. This is the problem of mass and scale, later expanded on by Samuel T. Francis in his book Leviathan and His Enemies, which I also discuss in Populist Illusion, and by James Burnham, who talked a lot about this as well. But this is the problem of mass and scale. Large memberships cannot coordinate without delegation and hierarchy. Specialization, that is, modern tasks which require expertise concentrated in a minority of trained officials. Okay, and in the realm of politics, this is often the legal side of things, it's the policy side of things, it's having the economic knowledge. Okay, all of these things are things that will gatekeep out any normal person from ever acquiring any of these roles. Or, you know, let's say some, you know, normal person does manage to get elected. They don't know what they're doing. And this is actually what happens a lot of the time. A lot of MPs don't know their ass from their elbow. And so all of these other people, these SPADs, these technical specialists, end up doing it for them or telling them what's what. This process is very well dramatized in the series The Thick of It, where the actual MP is shown to be so clueless, so kind of risibly hopeless, that they're just basically bossed around by the Malcolm Tuckers and the, you know, all of the Ollies and all of these sorts of characters. These are actually the people who are running things on the ground, and some people who watch this channel actually want to be those people. Very strange, if you ask me. But then again, those people will accumulate power because it's a certain personality type. And this is where Michels has some of this essentialist thinking from Pareto. Remember I talked about the residues and the derivations. Okay. I'm not the sort of person who'd ever want that job. I'm a scholar. I'm a, you know, I enjoy my life. I don't want to get involved in, you know, the nitty gritty of organization or worrying about, you know, oh, the 10 o'clock interview is coming up, you know, with my little, I could never do that job. I'm the wrong personality type. Now, you could argue that I've got some of these other skills here. I've got some degree of charismatic authority, right? But probably not enough to gravitate to these sorts of roles. And I'm frankly more interested in learning and other things. So I am the wrong personality type to get involved in any of this, which is why ultimately in the last analysis, I will just be a member of this. I mean, I'm not apathetic because I take an interest. Okay. But functionally speaking, I'm just another member of the mass because somebody else is going to do it. Okay. I'm just being honest, and I'm just trying to account for why it is this happens, because these roles attract certain sorts of people. The bureaucracy attracts a certain sort of person. The leadership roles, the charismatic roles, that's a certain sort of person, a person who's good at lying, a person who's good at sales, a person who's probably, I mean, I'm probably too honest for that sort of role myself. Okay. And I'm a little bit, I don't like people, right? So I'm not the right person for that role. You know, I also, in this role, in the technical specialist, where actually you're running the show there and you're taking on quite a lot of stuff. You actually have to be really on the ball. But also in that role, you have to be able to be a toady. You have to be able to be a kind of little, I mean, I can't be a number two like that. So there's all sorts of reasons why somebody like me doesn't get involved in politics. I'm not picking on myself as an example. I'm picking on myself as an example because you know who I am, right? But you hopefully will be thinking, well, what am I like? Would I ever get involved in that? Or would I ever get involved in that? And chances are you won't, because you're not quite of the right stripe. But the person who is of the right stripe is somebody of that stripe. And this is really what Michelle's is talking about. It's like, it's always going to be that guy, right? The weirdo from your school who wanted to be the school librarian and who loved being a prefect with a little badge, right? He's probably going to end up somewhere in that bureaucracy. He's made for it. Okay, yeah, your old school captain who was always the lead in the school plays, he might find himself in that leadership role. You know, and these sorts of spad characters who actually end up running things, who actually get a little something from the power that they have, that's another personality type. And lo and behold, that personality type will gravitate towards that. And you see, it's a self-perpetuating problem, which is why the iron law is so iron. Then there's speed. Effective responses to crisis demand, rapid centralized decision making. Okay, and this is also, I mean, this is basically why you need all of these functions, why you need centralization of command. And there's division of labor. The cognitive complexity of governance structurally favors those with sustained access and resources. The only check on all of this is constant renewal. And this is where Michels agrees with Mosca. He agrees with Pareto. Circulation is absolutely vital. He did not counsel despair. He offered only modest remedies. The iron law cannot be abolished. This is a fact of human life, regardless of what government you have, regardless of who is in power. This is just a fact. And Michels is pretty firm on it shall be no other way, whether you like it or not. And he, if you read political parties, is clearly frustrated with this fact. But it's like, look, this is realism, right? This is the real world now. Hard cheat. This is why it's called realism. because it's like, well, this is the way the world works, whether you like it or not. It can only be mitigated. The most effective check on the iron law is a vigorous circulation of elites, regular turnover, genuine accountability mechanisms, and an alert and demanding membership. But already in the remedy, the alert and demanding membership. So you're asking the disorganized mass to be focused, alert, and to pay attention. Is that ever going to happen? And you see, this is where we go back, right? This is why the iron law is so iron. The focus member, the membership who really takes an interest and cares, they're actually active. Try keeping them focused on the same thing for more than a week. Do you remember the revolution in Britain? Well, it's the World Cup now. Forget about it. It's the World Cup now. Oh, right. What happened? And this is the frustration. This is where Michel's constantly found himself frustrated. He's like, come on, comrades. Look, we can do something about it. You know, but the football's on, Robert. Come on, have a drink. We've got other things to do. And this is just the real world, I'm afraid. This is just the real world. Term limits are important for Michel. So this is one way of breaking the iron law. Although he does say, and I give many examples in the book, that even if you introduce term limits, is that the end? Tony Blair hasn't been in office since 2007. If you remember, what was his name? Nick Clegg. I agree with Nick. What happened to him? He went straight from his leader of the Lib Dems to some massive executive job in Facebook. David Miliband. Well, he went to work for Unilever or somebody like that, I seem to remember, or World, some massive NGO company after he left. So the point is that these people never truly go away. They never truly go away. And sometimes it's really visible. I mean, Lord Mandelson, I've mentioned him a few times. Look how many times he came back into power all the time, because elites have a habit of just kind of shuffling around amongst themselves, going into different parts, different, you know, they truly are a class, a ruling class. Anyway, transparent deliberation, competitive internal elections, and independent oversight can slow the entrenchment of oligarchy, though it can never eliminate this as a structural tendency. The lesson is not cynicism, but vigilance. Democratic organization must be perpetually defended from the logic of that their own success generates, although, as I've alluded to, the prospect of getting people all focused at the same time is kind of bleak, to say the least. That is the iron law of oligarchy. Robert Michel is a really interesting thinker. Let me know what you make of this in the comments. Now, I do know that left-wingers in general tend to have a problem with Robert Michel's. I always see things like, oh, well, he's a flawed thinker, or he's limited or something. But what that tends to translate as, in my experience, and, you know, writing this book, I did read lots of critiques of all of these thinkers. What it tended to translate into is, though, Robert Michel's is telling us we can't have our utopia. Robert Michel's is telling us that we can't have our lofty ideals. Basically, in a nutshell, it is the intellectual equivalent of not being able to take, you know, of coping and not being able to take the so-called black pill in the modern parlance. But that's all it is, really. You know, when they say he's limited, I mean, it's like, well, limited how? He's just explaining what happens. And they're saying, yeah, but he can't imagine that it could be otherwise. But now we're back in the realm of having to imagine something that's never happened before. And he, as a true Machiavellian, as a true realist, is like, I don't talk about ought. What is? The world I wanted didn't happen. The ideals of my youth when I was a socialist didn't happen. So what now? That is the rebuttal of Michel's. If you enjoyed this, you can pick up Populist Delusion and read more. Also, if you want real world examples, I use a lot of them in Applied Elite Theory. My course, The Foundations of Politics, is also available. And this is a good kind of companion piece. If you want to really, really learn this stuff, do the course and take and read this book alongside it. I have many other courses, The Trivium, of course, Economics, Research, Shakespeare. You can get them all in one amazing package, which is called the Ultra Bundle. Buy that today, and I'll catch you all next time. And prior warning, this ad comes in strong.
Ultra Bundle! 7 courses. Shakespeare! Research! The Trivium! Economics! Politics! The Ultra Bundle! Buy it now!
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.